Okay, well, let's get, I put in the bulletin, we had talked about this, the possibility of starting even 5 minutes earlier, and here we haven't done it, though Gibbs is coming only first at noon or something. He's got another appointment, and the lessons aren't quite so long this time, but I'm going to exhort us to start promptly and give us a little bit more time. The lessons for today, I'm just checking here. I'm not sure that I... Yeah, okay, this is straight out of the lectionary, except for the gospel. I think if you check the lectionary, you'll notice that the gospel for Palm Sunday is the entire Mark 14:15, or as a second choice, only Mark 15, that is the crucifixion stuff. And are you aware of the reason for this? My understanding was that the change in the lectionary that was made with the three-year cycle redesignated Palm Sunday as the Sunday of the Passion. And the readings were intended to focus on Holy Week. Hence, you have these very lengthy readings of the virtual Passion history. The reason for that is really less than sanctified. My understanding of it was that this was somewhat of a concession to the fact that fewer and fewer people go to midweek Lenten services, where if your congregation follows any sort of the tradition, you find that you have a reading of the Passion narrative going on, and you kind of read through the whole story week by week. And the switch was made to Palm Sunday on the assumption that for most of the people, this would be their only chance to hear the Passion narrative, because they wouldn't have been there during the week, see? All of which is fine and dandy, except that it takes the emphasis off of Palm Sunday, see? And you never get to read the Palm Sunday story. Were I in a parish, I think I would at this point continue to have Wednesday night services and encourage people to come, and if you don't come Wednesday night, you've missed something, and then restore the integrity of Palm Sunday and read the Palm Sunday thing. So remember, the lectionary is not part of our confessional or biblical heritage, and certainly can be subject to change, but not cavalierly either. Well, enough of my editorial soapbox. At least the Old Testament lesson is both in the lectionary and pertains to the traditional Palm Sunday reading, and it's Zechariah 9, 9, and 10. Let's take a look here. I'm just curious, how many of you are in right now in a fieldwork church where they're confirming on Palm Sunday? Well, that's interesting. Maybe you don't even know, you're not involved in that, huh? How many of you come from a congregation where that was the tradition and still is, to confirm on Palm Sunday? Yeah. Well, that's not the issue here. I'm just kind of curious how many a lot of congregations have moved from that. That was kind of the old way of doing it. You confirmed on Palm Sunday, and I think the reason for that was that your first communion would be Monday, Thursday then. And there are pros and cons for that. I mean, this isn't the first thing you take on when you become a pastor of a congregation. And believe me, there's some long-standing feelings about when my child's going to be confirmed, because if I was confirmed on Palm Sunday, I think my child ought to be confirmed on Palm Sunday. But the problem from an educational point of view is that your school year, if you tie this to an instructional program, shifts by 5 or 6 weeks every year. This year with Easter early, it's really tough to get through all six chief parts, if you will. Well, that's a topic for another day. Gilim me'od bat Zion, ha'ri'i bat Yerushalayim. Wow, it's great text, huh? Gili, let's parse a few verbs. Gili is from the hollow root, gil. Gil, as in Hava Nagila. All right? Hava Nagila. Nagila is the cohortative imperfect. You hear the nun there, and the comments say at the end, Nagila, for rejoice. Gil means rejoice. So Hava Nagila means come on, let's rejoice. Okay? Here, the form is Gili. The E is the second singular feminine imperfect ending, but without the imperfect prefix, it's imperative. So it is the imperative rejoice, addressed to a singular feminine, namely Bastion. Okay, daughter. Now here's this old sort of translational crux. Is this a construct chain, daughter of Sion, which is the way it's almost always translated, or is it appositional, daughter, i.e. Sion, daughter Zion? And you'll find arguments going both ways. I am of the opinion that we ought to entertain the latter choice, that Zion is the daughter. Otherwise, you're forced with the question, who is the daughter of Zion? See? It's really Zion that we're talking about here, perceived here as the daughter of God. I suppose most people would say the daughter of Zion means the people themselves as opposed to the city. But daughter in Hebrew or Semitic idiom doesn't mean people, it means the villages. The daughter of a city is really sort of what we'd call the suburbs. Okay, the outlying villages that depend on the city for commerce and defense. So that isn't really the idiom. So I think it's daughter Zion. And you got the same problem in the second half. Hari'i Bath Jerusalem, daughter Jerusalem. See, Jerusalem is the daughter. Though I'm not saying that's the only, the better. I think it's the better way. Hari'i, parse it. This is now a hifil imperative of the hollow root. I think the root is rua with a wow in the middle as the mater letter, rua. But again, feminine singular. The hay, of course, is hifil with the a vowel is hifil imperative. And rua means something like whoop it up. Rua really means to make a loud shouting noise, usually one of joy for victory. This is what you did after the battle was won. You whooped it up in joy. So give a victory shout. Might not be a bad translation. A barbaric? Yelp. Why barbaric? It's not necessarily barbaric. Okay. Give a cry aloud. I guess it's sometimes translated a little bit weakly just as shout aloud, but it's usually for joy because of the victory. Hine, here's why we're crying aloud. All right, interesting that the victory hasn't come yet or not. Hine malkeik yavo lak. Hine, behold, looky here. Pay attention to what's before you. Malkeik, this is melech with the second singular feminine. Your here is still feminine because it refers to Bath Zion. Your melech, yavo, now this is really imperfect, will come, future, lak, to you. Now we have adjectives, tzadik v'nosha, who? Tzadik, these are vocabulary you should know, tzadik is righteous. Nosha is a little trickier. Do you see the root here? This is from yasha. It's really a participle. The nun is the nun of the nifal participle of yasha. And it's difficult to translate because yasha, if you remember, occurs naturally in the hifil. So what do you do? So the passive of the hifil should be the hafal. What do you do with the nifal? It doesn't, yasha is hardly ever used in the kal. So why would you have a nifal? So, and it probably is something more middle reflexive than passive. See, if it were the passive of the kal, then you'd have to translate this as one who is being saved. See, while I think the nifal has more of this reflexive sense, not so much saving himself, but having salvation inherent with himself. Now, having said that, I want to put the brakes on what is perhaps a far too obvious overinterpretation of that into the person and work of Christ. But hey, it works, all right? I mean, I'm not sure I build a whole sort of two paragraphs in your sermon based on what is really kind of a difficult translational issue. You got to You know, that's kind of what I would call a sort of a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing kind of error in exegesis, that you stumble into some great insight based on some rare word, and you're off and running with some tremendous theological construction that frankly isn't based on good evidence. It's based on a difficult word, all right? And it's nice to have at least two witnesses before you start constructing theological theories, not to mention homiletical applications. But the translations will reflect a little bit of difficulty here. Righteous and having salvation, is he, the who at the end is just the pronoun. Or is it righteous and I've tried the word salvific, though it doesn't ring too well from the lectern. It kind of gets the idea. He is salvific, that is, himself embodies what it means to provide salvation. Whew. Ani, all right, this all sounds pretty good. Here's the righteous and saving king coming. Ani varokev al chamor. Ani, humble. Ani, humble. Can also mean poor, but this is poor in the sense of just kind of beat up by circumstances. Humble. And kind of recognizing it. Humble and rokev, riding. Rakav means to ride, a horse. Riding upon a chamor. Now, a lot is always made about the donkey here, a chamor. That this is the sign of humility, fair enough, but you got to be a little bit careful. It can't quite be stated that this was terribly unusual to have a king come in on a donkey, because kings came on steeds, on stallions, on white horses over the hill, see? And while there's a little bit of an unusual twist to this, it can't be said that a king would never ride a donkey. Right? In fact, kings did ride donkeys. The difference is the posture of the king, whether he's coming as a warrior or coming as sort of coming in war or coming in peace. And the donkey is a symbol of sort of humble peace than it is of triumphant war. And in that sense is still a very good contrast to the sense of this victory that we have in the beginning of this verse, all right? He's both victorious and triumphant, and we're shooting or shouting and whooping it up. And at the same time, he's kind of quiet and humble and coming in a more modest way. I also think the other sort of exegetical insight here is that this is the way it all started back in a Judges period, and I think it's a little bit of a dig at what the monarchy had become by the time it was destroyed, where the king was pretty much a big shot instead of a humble servant, all right? And riding a horse would be the sign of a guy coming as a big shot. He's got to rent a limo to get to church on Sunday. When instead the king is supposed to come in at least a little bit more ordinary mode of transportation. You probably say the same thing about a pastor. Right? How would you feel about a congregation where the pastor arrives in a chauffeur limo every Sunday morning? This would not be appropriate, unless you're a TV evangelist or something, and thereby hangs another tale. And upon a colt, and the son of a type of animal represented by female donkeys. That's what about the best you can do with that odd plural. Achanoth, and Achon is a female donkey and it's plural. Why is it plural? Did he have more than one mother? I think this is the so-called plural of classification or so. There's a good, Jeff, you'll always appreciate a classification. Yeah, right, you got it. If you can put it in a box, you can control it. And upon a colt, the son of a type of animal represented by female donkeys. 10. Vehik rati. Ooh, good parsing here. Karath, cut off. Hik, hifiel. Note the shift to the first person, though. And I will cut off the rekev. Now, we just had rakav for ride, so this is the noun for chariot, or even collectively, chariot tree, right? Not the infantry, but what do you call it? The cav? No, not the cav. What do you call the machines, tanks and stuff? Artillery. No, that's guns. I don't know. Tanks and stuff. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and horse and Seuss from Jerusalem. Note that both Ephraim and Jerusalem are in the game here. This is north and south together, the Una Sancta Ecclesia. Involves all of Israel, not just Judah, even though the north is long gone. We're post-exilic here, remember. So this is all sort of echoes of once was and is no more, but will be. Where am I? 10b. And Karath, again, the same verb, cut off. Here it's in the passive, the Niphal perfect third singular feminine. She will be cut off. What's the subject? The Keshet Milchama. Keshet, you may not know, that's the bow, as in bow and arrow. The bow of war, the Keshet Milchama, the bow of battle, will be cut off. And now we get a fourth line here. These three are all removing implements of war, and the fourth line is positive, and deber shalom lagoyim, and he will declare shalom lagoyim, to the goyim. Got it? Who's the subject? He. It's got to be the king, the melech of verse 9b, right? He's arrived on the scene now. I'm going to do all this stuff, I being Yahweh, and now he's going to declare shalom. And mushlo, his mashal, you want to parse mushlo? Kal, infinitive construct with pronominal suffix. Oh, the so-called cuddle form, and his mashal-ing, his rule-ing. Mashal means to rule. And his mashaling, you have to supply the verb now, is or will be, miyam ad yam, from sea unto sea, and min nahar, and from the river. The nahar is always the Euphrates in the Bible, and it becomes sort of metaphor for the end of the word earth going east. Am I directions right? Yeah, the end of the earth going east. And the end of the earth going west is usually the islands in the sea, okay? So here we've got from sea to sea, from the river unto the ends of the earth. Arts. That's the end of the text, and we're right on schedule here. Any questions? I do want to make at least a comment on verse 11, which isn't part of the pericope, but is a key verse here. Gam at bedam birithek. Also you, tough to translate, because of the dam of your berith, the blood of your covenant. This is an unusual phrase here, but suddenly we got covenant blood language into this thing. Shilachti, I will expel, in the PL, your prisoners from a bor, from a pit, ein mayim bo, there ain't no water in it. All right, in which there is no water, which was the worst kind of bore to be in, because you couldn't climb out and you couldn't live down there. That's why they threw prisoners in there. Remember Joseph? I can't. I guess I could do 12 quickly yet. Return to your fortress, to the fortress. Oh, and this is a great little nine. Asire ha-tikwa, prisoners of hope. Tikwa. Today I will, or will someone will declare, a double portion I will restore to you. 11 and 12, I think, really add to this sense that this has to do with the blood of the covenant, whatever Zechariah meant. It makes a lot more sense now. And then he's got this prisoners being released motif, speaks to the restoration and the new age that we sort of have in verse 9-10 when the king comes announcing that, hey, life has changed forever. It's no longer business as usual, even now, not to mention in eternity. There's going to be no more war. We can take all this stuff and remove it, swords into plowshares stuff. Okay? I mean, that this pertains now to what happens on Palm Sunday is pretty loaded. Okay, Jeff, any questions while he's coming up? Now, we're in Mark. I explained why we're doing Mark 11 and not 14.